Are you searching for ways to increase your mental focus in life or in the mountains? Look no further than Behind the Sun Therapeutics. Owned and operated by prolific alpinist Samuel Johnson, Behind the Sun Therapeutics is a private mental health and mental coaching practice based in Seward, Alaska. Samuel, who is featured in the Fernline episode, Mindful Mountaineer, has made numerous first ascents spanning from Alaska to Asia and many places in between. Samuel is excited to offer performance-oriented mental coaching for risk-oriented sports to clients based around the world, as well as mental health services for clients within the state of Alaska. For more information, contact Behind the Sun Therapeutics via phone at 907-422-7504 or by email at behindthesuntherapeutics@gmail.com. Hey friends, I'm Evan Phillips, and you're listening to The Fernline, a podcast about the lives of mountain climbers. On season two, I'm chatting with alpinists and other outdoor enthusiasts who are pushing the limits of creativity in the mountains and in their daily lives. My goal is to have meaningful conversations with an extraordinary group of people, the folks who choose to live full value lifestyles in some of the most beautiful and wild regions on the planet. All right. Well, it's great to be back with you for another episode of The Fernline. So a few weeks ago, I asked listeners to send me recordings describing what living a full value lifestyle means to them. I got some great responses, and I wanted to take a minute to share a few of those. And this first one comes from Sophia up in Fairbanks, Alaska.
To me, a full-value lifestyle means prioritizing the small things that make you feel alive and fulfilled, whether that's backcountry skiing, having potlucks with friends, or making art. It's about intentionally stripping life down to the simple things and taking chances on the things that bring you joy.
And this next one is from Fernline listener Matt Williams.
When I first started climbing at 18, full value was pretty much everything that I did, but it was really because I just didn't know what I was doing, but I was out there going for it. Today, as a 54-year-old grandfather who still climbs, but has also had to deal with a lot of injuries, I've had to redefine what full value is. And it's really just an attitude that you bring with you every day. I still love being high up on a mountain ridge, but full value is also little things like hearing the squawk of a red-tailed hawk, even if I'm just out working on the ranch, or seeing the look on my grandson's face when he saw a coyote the other day as it crossed right in front of us. Full value can be taking a new climber on their first multi-pitch, even if it's just an easy climb, and feeling their joy as they experience their first successful summit. Life is short, so make every day full value.
Hey, so thanks a lot to Matt and Sophia for participating and sharing your thoughts. I feel like you both summed it up pretty damn well. So I really enjoyed getting these recordings, and I wanted to extend another invite for listeners to participate. And for this next round, I want you to send me recordings of ways you like to listen to The Fernline. I know some folks like to listen on their way to work or during work, and other people like to listen during road trips or even on bivvies on mountains and big walls. Again, you can just do simple voice recordings on your phone and email them to me at thefernline@gmail.com. All right, so with that, it's time to grab your favorite beverage and get cozy on your couch or camp chair and settle in for this episode of The Fernline.
I had to like come to terms with climbing in my own life and figure out why it was so important, why it was something that I was so fixated on. And part of that process for me was just to like come to terms with how hard climbing can be, you know, how challenging it can be in someone's life.
On today's episode, we'll get to know author and climber Chris Kalman. Growing up in suburban Northern Virginia, Chris was exposed to academia and team sports from a young age. But by the time he reached high school, Chris had discovered rock climbing and was instantly hooked. Always a deep thinker, the solitary process of combining fitness with problem solving appealed to him. But it wasn't until he moved out west after college to work trail crew at Rocky Mountain National Park that a new world of adventure and self-discovery emerged. Since that time, Kalman has forged an adventurous, almost Kerouac-style path through life. This quest has taken him from the technical granite test pieces of Index Washington to the sweeping big walls of Cochimo in southern Chile. But Chris's search isn't just about climbing. Rather, it's a pursuit of self-examination, meaningful relationships with others, and a journey toward a deeper understanding of life. I recently got a chance to sit down with Chris and talk about everything, ranging from his formative experiences working for the National Park Service, the challenges of dealing with loss, and his acclaimed new book, As Above, So Below. We started our conversation by talking about Chris's experience growing up in the suburbs and how that led to a life out west, climbing and writing.
I went climbing at a summer camp when I was like, I don't know, 7 years old or something. And I was actually too young, but it was my dad's cousin owned the camp. So they like let me go on this climbing trip. And I remember really enjoying that. And then like as a kid, there was this book that someone gave me called Banner in the Sky, which is this kid's book about this kid that loses his father in a climbing accident in the Alps. And then he becomes this climber. So like it'd be really easy to wax philosophical and be like, all the signs were there. But, you know, realistically, like I grew up in the suburbs in Northern Virginia and I was like I wanted to be a professional basketball player, even though my parents are like 5'5 and 5'4. And like I wanted to be a professional football player, and at one point, I think I want to be a professional soccer player. I was just like a normal suburban white boy who was kind of interested in, you know, regular team sports. And that kind of took me up to like high school. And I think like when I was 16, I did hallucinogenic mushrooms, like did psychedelics for the first time. And it really shattered my worldview. Like I was kind of a staunch and hard-nosed. But I think of it as like a formative event, because up until then, I had kind of believed that science was the gospel. You know, I didn't have religion, but I was religious about science. My mom's an aeronautical physicist. My dad's a mathematician. And I was like, that which could be proven demonstrably is true, and that which can't is just bogus. And I ate mushrooms and it kind of flipped my worldview and made me believe in paradox and the coexistence of opposites. And that started me on this trajectory that was like, life is more complicated than you think, and it's also more beautiful than you realize. And you got to do whatever you can to get the most out of life, because it's this incredible gift and this huge opportunity. And so like organized sports was no longer really on my radar at that time. I didn't really care about school. I wrote religiously because I've loved reading and writing ever since I was a kid. Mm-hmm. But this was right around when climbing made an appearance. I had a friend who was a member of a climbing gym, and he asked me if I wanted to come. So I went with him one day. And I remember looking at the walls and just being like, this is really weird. Like, I thought we were going to go rock climbing. There's like these weird plastic structures and all this tape everywhere. It seems really dumb. I remember, like, on that very first day, trying a boulder problem, falling, trying it again, falling again, trying again, falling again, and eventually figuring out some sequence or some beta or whatever, and then sending. And it was this moment where I was like, wow, it's not about being stronger. It's about being smarter.
Right.
Learning how to put your body through these puzzles and figuring out sequence. And that immediately attracted me. I mean, I was hooked from day one.
Right.
I ended up going to college in Southern Maryland simply because I didn't really want to participate in like the whole go apply to 25 colleges, blah, blah, blah. Like, I found like one college that seemed like it would be fine to me, and I kind of wanted to like stick it to my parents and be like, I'll be happy wherever I go, so I'm not going to participate in that. But then like I got there and I was like starting to fall in love with climbing, and I was like 2 hours from the nearest top rope location, an hour plus to the nearest like professional climbing gym, 5 hours from the nearest decent bouldering, and 7 hours from the nearest sport climbing.
Yeah.
But it just didn't stop me. Like, I was that obsessed.
Right.
And I had a couple of friends who were good partners. Like, it was really funny. Like, my friend Miranda Oakley, who's, like, I would argue one of the top female trad climbers in the world right now.
Wow.
I mean, she's just, like, 5'13 on-site climber. And, yeah, she was, like, one of my first partners. And I remember we, together with my friend Matt Rowey, like put in for one rope and 8 quick draws and like went out to the New River Gorge and got on anything that we could that was like, you know, 6 bolts long so we could make an anchor.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I initially got hooked on the puzzle factor or aspect of it. But then as soon as you went outside, there was adrenaline. And that adrenaline, I think, in the long run, has been the bigger pull.
Right.
And then after college, I ended up going out to, I got a job straight away in Rocky Mountain National Park in Colorado. And it suddenly just felt so absurd to climb boulders and sport climbs when you were staring at these giant mountains.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, that's not a judgment on anyone else, whatever. But for me, it was just like, oh, I feel like, you know, it just felt really silly.
Yeah.
I couldn't not look at those peaks and feel like I had to climb them. You know, with bouldering, I got up to VX, you know, whatever, V whatever, and then couldn't like on-site or send it in 3 tries anymore. So I was like, all right, well, I'll try sport climbing. And got up to like 5 blank and, you know, it was like, oh, now I can't progress in sport climbing without, you know, doing pull-ups or whatever the stuff you're supposed to do, going jogging.
Yeah.
So I was like, all right, well, I'm done sport climbing. Now I'll go trad climbing. And so I, you know, did the same thing with trad climbing. But with trad climbing, you didn't have to, I didn't hit a wall. I mean, I honestly would say I still haven't hit a wall with trad climbing, even though it's been my focus since probably like 2008 or 2009 or something. Because of the risk involved with certain types of trad climbing,
right,
or like the ability to go put up new routes, like you can be totally maxed out emotionally, psychologically, and as far as your thought process goes, like your brain can be totally maxed out. And you can improve all of those things without having to do any pull-ups or right, pick up any training manuals.
Right.
Which I didn't feel was really the case with sport climbing and bouldering.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just suits me. Like, I've never wanted to work out. Like, I've never been one to do sit-ups or go to a gym to do hangboard workouts or anything.
I get the sense that you're an adventure climber.
I love cragging. Like, I love testing myself on really high quality routes that have like really memorable sequences. But yeah, if I had like a perfect partner living in town, there's this mountain that rises over my house now, and it's got a bunch of weird looking little escarpments that, you know, you'd have to bushwhack for 2 hours to get to. And if I had like the partner that wanted to do that, like I would just do that instead of go mini tractioning at, like, you know, Paradise Forks or something. Right. That's definitely what I like to do most now.
Yeah. So you said you got a job with Rocky Mountain National Park. What were you doing?
That's right. So I was working trail crew, and
nice.
Yeah. And it was a really, like, I've worked for 3 different national parks, and I think it's some of the best work I've ever done in my life. And it's a really awesome organization. And it was great for me to be in Rocky. The trail crew there was like all very intelligent, very interesting, forward thinking, you know, progressive individuals just doing this backbreaking manual labor at like 12,000 feet. Like, it didn't take me long to realize that my body wouldn't be able to keep up with that for many years. Like, I'm 5'5", 130, and, or maybe I'm 140. I mean, I just thought these dudes were so awesome, and I really wanted to pull my weight. So, you know, I think I pushed myself a little too hard. And then on the weekends, it would be like, okay, now I've got to climb to, you know, keep my brain. Like, I had never been surrounded by rock like that, you know? And so I would spend all week thinking about climbing and looking at rocks and just being like, oh my God, I got to climb. The weekend would come, and no matter how exhausted, it'd be like, all right, I got to go climbing. So I didn't really recover that for any of those 3 summers that I was out there.
Yeah. I don't know if you are now or would consider now, but at a certain time in your life, like, you're definitely a quintessential dirt bag.
Yeah.
Kind of when did that start? And kind of what did that lifestyle look like for you?
It's a fair question, and I'm not sure what the exact answer would be. Like, I was already dumpster diving in college. Like, I lived in the woods temporarily in college before I got kicked out by the public safety. Yeah, like, I've always, like, when I was in middle school or whatever, I had an allowance, and it was less than my friend's allowance, and we would go bowling. Like, for some reason, I was into bowling in middle school, and I would barely have enough to pay for the bowling, and then we'd go out to Burger King afterwards or whatever, and I didn't have enough money to get the food, so I would, like, ask my friends for their change after they paid for their meal.
Right.
You know, so, like, you could say maybe, like, the dirtbaggery goes back that far.
Yeah, totally.
With my first paycheck after college, I bought a plane ticket to Thailand to go sport climbing there right after I was going to get laid off because it was a seasonal job. And the park service, you get really cheap housing, so I was able to live for cheap. There was really good dumpster diving in Boulder at that time, and so I would make trips down from Estes Park down to Boulder to go dumpster diving on my weekends. I even remember I made my buddy Bryce, we went to Rifle, and I was like, look, I'll go with you, but we have to dumpster Boulder on the way back. And it ended up being like, I didn't realize at the time, but it was a huge detour. We could have just taken the Peak to Peak highway. And it's just, I mean, yeah, I was like that for a long time. I've always been kind of a penny pincher, probably to a fault.
Right.
But yeah, I'd guess like the transitional moment would probably be, I ended up leaving my job at Rocky, partially because I complained about it too much because it, you know, my body was getting thrashed. It just wasn't my dream. And my girlfriend was sort of encouraging me to, you know, be a little more ambitious. And so, like, I left Rocky, and then the girlfriend and I broke up, and I ended up losing a tooth in a kind of a long, boring story, but I was missing a front tooth, and I was working on a pot farm in Southern Oregon trying to not climb because I was like, climbing's the reason for all of my problems, and it's such a selfish pursuit, doesn't do anything for anyone, I need to not climb. But it was... that was short-lived. So yeah, I mean, I was like unemployed, collecting unemployment, living off food stamps on a pot farm in Southern Oregon, sleeping in a tent.
Missing a front tooth.
Missing a front tooth, like getting my clothes from the thrift store or whatever. I guess that was like the real dirt bag, the height of my dirt baggery.
Yeah. And I would imagine, I mean, only because I've been there in so many, you know, in so many ways in my own life, like I understand that there's like an immense sense of freedom that comes along with that, but it's also can be really dark and really stressful. And it sounds like maybe that's what it was for you, you know, kind of all of those things happening at once.
You know, there, it was like hard. It was hard, but I think the hardest part about it was just trying to quit climbing. And as soon as I stopped fighting that, it just became like some of the best years of my life, I think.
Nice.
Because then I was just like, well, no, screw it. I'm just gonna go climb wherever and whenever I want, because that's kind of what I need to do in my life right now.
Rose-colored shades, thoughts rearranged. Snow line is coming down on the trees. When the rains turn to rime and the sea keep time, there's a feeling I get, seems like yesterday. Oh, stay here tonight. Keep me.
During this time, Chris began pushing himself to write more, and he even finished his first manuscript. But it was an out-of-the-blue, shot-in-the-dark job application that would land him on the slopes of Mount Rainier as a climbing ranger. Although his experiences on Rainier would teach him a multitude of life lessons, it was the ensuing experiences climbing at Index and putting up new routes in Cochimo in southern Chile that would open his mind to new possibilities in climbing and writing.
And your mind doesn't wait for the time it might take. Settle down and get your feet firmly planted.
Two things happened. One, wrote my first manuscript, and that was like the first time that I was just bullheaded about finishing. You know, I was like, I'm not gonna quit, I'm not gonna give up, like I'm gonna stick with it. So I finished a manuscript, and like it'll never see the light of day, and that's fine. It doesn't need to. But that was really important for me, just to kind of teach myself or remind myself that like I can do something like that. Like I can finish it. And then the other thing that happened was I was actually back on the East Coast at my parents' house in the spring, and I got a call out of the blue from Mount Rainier National Park. And I like to collect unemployment, you have to apply for jobs. And so one of the jobs I had applied for was as a climbing ranger on Mount Rainier. And I was like, well, I'll never get that job, but whatever, it checks the box. And so they called me like 2 weeks before start date and were just like, do you want this job? And I was like, hey, look, yes, but you have to understand that I don't know how to ski. I don't own skis. I don't know how to put on crampons. I've never worn crampons before. And I have no medical certifications, and I don't know what I put on my application, but that's the facts. And they were like, all right, well, so when can you start? So I don't know like what happened there or like who's screwed up in HR or what, but I ended up getting that job, and that was freaking amazing. Like yeah. I had 8 days on, 6 days off. All of my time off, I would go climbing at Index, which I would argue is the best cragging in the world.
Wow.
Certainly the best I've ever done.
Wow.
You can do whatever you want there, like as far as single pitch, multi pitch, hard trad, hard sport, whatever. And like the climbing is just really cerebral.
Right.
And so it suits me perfectly.
Yeah.
Like I'm not, you know, it wasn't like, crap, I need to go do pull-ups. It was like, okay, figure out where to put your feet and in what order and when to turn your head to the left so that you can move up your right, you know, that whole thing.
Yeah.
And so I was able to focus on climbing. And then what happened was I had money again. And so when my buddy Grant asked if I wanted to go down to Cochamó in southern Chile, I was able to be like, yeah, screw it, let's do it. And so that first trip to Cochamó really was a sea change for me in how I thought about climbing, because we climbed this 1,000-meter route called Bienvenido a mi Insomnio, which is like 11 minus, and it's really fun. And the biggest thing either of us had ever climbed before that was the Diamond, which is like six pitches. I mean, there's more involved with the Diamond, but, you know, it's like a six-pitch route to do the casual route. And so I was like, wow, we can climb big things. And then also I ended up putting up a new route with my friend JB Hobb, and he kind of took me under his wing and showed me, like, how new routing works. And then it was like, holy shit, not only can I climb big things, but I can, like, start at the bottom of something and know nothing about it and figure out how to get to the top.
Right.
But then I was like, this is what I want to do. And so I kind of had like these two things in the back of my mind with doing new routes and like going on expeditions and then writing. And I had kind of been publishing articles here and there sporadically in climbing publications. So I every once in a while I would make a couple hundred bucks and I'd be like, huh, I wonder if this is something I could do like in the long term. And it all kind of came to a head my second season at Rainier, and that's when we lost my coworker Nick Hall. So he was a climbing ranger and ended up dying in the course of this rescue where they totally saved this team of four, like saved their lives. And he ended up taking a long ride down the mountain, and that was that. And it was just a wake-up call for me that, like, the way I rationalized Nick's death was Nick really loved being out in that kind of terrain. Like, he was definitely a mountaineer first. He was a badass skier. He loved being on the snow. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, you know, at least he died doing what he loved. But for me, slogging up the DC or the Emmons Winthrop, like, that was not at all what I loved. It suddenly felt like the risk entailed in that job wasn't worth it anymore just for the paycheck.
Right.
Or for the awesome schedule and the camaraderie. I mean, it was a hard decision. Like, that was an awesome job, and it was a great crew of people. But I just needed to take some time away from it and think about things. And I was living in Seattle, roofing, working for a moving company, spending my spare hours after I'd get home from whatever manual labor job, searching Craigslist for other jobs. And with all of my spare time, I was writing, because I just had like a couple of little writing gigs that were starting to pay. And I was just like, this is the only thing that seems to be working. And that trend continued for like 4 years. Like, I, to this day, I still apply for jobs, you know, like I apply for jobs. I even interviewed for a job recently, like, but I don't know if there's something in my voice or like the way I write emails, but I seem to be like bug repellent for hiring officials, and I just can't get a job to save my life. And so I've had to stick with writing because I didn't have any other options. Like, it was the only thing that was working.
As climbers, we all have places that hold special meaning to us, whether it be our favorite roadside crag or some isolated glacier in the middle of nowhere. For Chris, it was the walls of Index that captivated him with clean granite cracks, technical sequences, and cerebral face climbing. I asked Chris to talk about his experience climbing at Index and how it led him to write the seminal guidebook, The Index Town Walls, a guidebook to Washington's finest crag.
You Yeah, so when I started climbing at Index, the guidebook that existed was out of print, and you couldn't get it. There is like a spiral bound book that was made by Clint Cummins, which you could buy at the Index General Store, and you could print off online, and it was nice. Totally crowdsourced and free, and it's like, you know, that thing is awesome, but like, I wanted something that was almost like a coffee table book to celebrate Index, because it took like 3 days at Index for it to become my favorite climbing place I'd ever been to. And I wanted like a keepsake that I could cherish, you know, almost like a, I don't know, a souvenir of the place. And I thought also that there would probably be a lot of other people that felt that way too. Simultaneously, the more I climbed at Index, the more I realized that there were a lot, like at Index, there's the lower wall, which is a like a 2 minute walk from the parking lot. Mm-hmm. And unless you're, you know, a 514 granite climber, it could probably satisfy you for your whole life. You know, like you could probably work on like a mandala, a narrow arrow overhang for many years, unless you're a very, very gifted climber. But anyway, all the other walls you have to walk to. Not very far compared to normal crags, but you have to walk. And I would start exploring and realize that this route or that had bolts that needed to be replaced, or they were totally in disrepair. They were covered in moss or lichen or whatever. And I started to think of the book as a way to spread traffic out at Index. Because, you know, like you would, once you cleaned a route off and made it safe, when you climbed it, the quality is high all the way throughout. Like every crag at Index has incredible quality stone and some of the best pitches like anywhere in the world. Wow. And so, you know, I thought about the using the book as a tool to draw attention to what exists kind of hidden in the forest to the average climber and encourage them to get out there. And so at the time that I was writing it with Maddie, and Maddie was like, I did all the words, Maddie did all the photos, but we did all the groundwork together, like all right. the recon. Right. We were seeing an explosion at Index way before the guidebook came out. It was already becoming far more busy from a climbing perspective. And so it started to feel really imperative to spread that traffic out.
Yeah.
And so for me, like caring about the guidebook was exactly the same as caring about Index. Like I just wanted to give something back to that place and to try and preserve it and protect it in a way that would allow it to continue to see growth in a sustainable manner.
What was the response from the climbing community about you taking on this project? Yeah, you know, I know that there, like, people can get really weird about guidebooks.
Totally. And it was like, there were a lot of people that were like, you're destroying Index. People started making these, like bumper stickers that say Index sucks and like throwing them on signs around Index. I mean, Index is like, it has a really peculiar, unique, eccentric community of people. And even though I would get totally steamed sometimes, like I'm glad that the place that I chose to write a guidebook for, that the community cares about it enough to be like skeptical of a guidebook
right.
author.
Right.
Because, yeah, an unscrupulously done guidebook can have negative effects on an area. It's guaranteed to increase traffic, right? Guidebooks always do that.
Yeah.
If it's not like written in a way that sort of pushes and promotes the local values and ethics, then it's a big problem.
Right.
And so I tried my best to take it in stride. I didn't always succeed in that, but there were a lot of people that were naysayers. But when the book finally did come out and people got to get eyes on it, I think most of that disappeared. I'm sure there are still some people who are like, Chris Kalman's an asshole, fuck that guy, he ruins everything. And like, I'm not even saying they're wrong. It's just, you know, they're coming at it from a different perspective, which is, a lot of people feel ownership of Index, like it's their place.
Right, of course.
And maybe because they've been climbing there for 20 years or something, it's like they have more authority, or their opinion matters more than like yeah. someone who's been climbing there for 2 weeks.
Right.
That's like an interesting aesthetic argument. But as far as from a legal perspective, the landowner is in this case, like a national forest and a state park, they have the say.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So like I was trying to be really conscientious about like those land managers and Index have always been like really laissez-faire with Index climbers. And I wanted to continue that tradition by like working with them and encouraging climbers to obey the few norms and rules that they impose on us.
So what was the most important thing that you feel like you learned as far as being a writer in the process of publishing a book from the ground up? What did you learn doing that book, and how did it set you up for your more recent projects?
Well, from a writing perspective, it was interesting. Like, there wasn't much editorial direction, which I'm happy with. I think, like, the team I worked with at Sharp End were incredible. And if I ever did a guidebook again, I would 100% work with them again because they were so great. And I think that if I had wanted editorial direction, they would have provided it, but they were pretty hands-off. And so I think part of the learning experience was just almost like getting permission. You know, it was like I suddenly had permission to do things the way I thought they should be done, which when you write for a climbing magazine, doesn't matter what the magazine is, that's almost never the case. Like,
that's what I hear.
Yeah, like magazines have departments. And it's not like I'm not criticizing magazines. They have a hard job. And, yeah, you know, they've got departments, and they want those they want the pieces that go into those departments to fit a certain bill. And that's just how it works. I've had like one piece or two pieces maybe that went through almost no edits, but everything else is just like endless back and forth. And you know, it's like a real collaborative process. And that can be super frustrating if you're coming at it from an artistic perspective and you're like, well, I don't really want to write a department piece. Like, I have this piece. It's ready for something. I'm asking if you want it. But then that just means you probably shouldn't be trying to publish in a magazine, because that's not how that works.
We all have our own ways of dealing with loss, and this is especially true in the climbing world, where the specter of death can oftentimes loom like a perpetual fog. One of the ways Chris has dealt with grief in his life is to write about it. And in fact, it was a string of painful losses that were the catalyst for him writing his new book, As Above, So Below. I asked Chris to talk about this experience and how it has impacted his life moving forward as a writer and a climber.
Yeah, so let me set the scene. I'm living in Seattle, or actually at this point I was living in Index. So I quit my job with the Park Service. I'm living in Index. My girlfriend is all the way on the other side of the country in Maryland, working for her dad. And I'm working on the guidebook and, you know, trying to figure out, like, you know, what's going on with my life. And I'm hanging from a fixed line, scrubbing this route, and I get a call from my girlfriend. And I pick up and she's crying. And she tells me that her dad's just been diagnosed with cancer. That was in August. I think I had everything packed up and had moved back to Maryland by September, at some point in September. And like my friends and I had just applied for this COP Dash Award, or we had just gotten a COP Dash Award to go in the winter down to Torres del Paine and try a new route on this feature called Cerro Catedral. The diagnosis with Megan's father, Kevin, got basically worse and worse every time he went to a doctor at all. And eventually I decided to bail on the trip to the Paine just because it was like the timing didn't make sense, you know? And I kind of knew that I needed to be there for my girlfriend, or basically needed to, if I decided not to be there, I would expect her to break up with me. And I think that would have been the right decision, you know, because if that's the kind of partner I was, like, that's not really a partner worth having. And so the day before my friends left on their flight, that was the day that Kevin passed away. And this was like a really hard and challenging time for me for a variety of reasons. First of all, Kevin was an exceptional and just amazing person. He was very healthy. He was very young. It sucks. Like, he shouldn't have died. And it's just bad luck, or I don't know. I don't know what makes one person get, you know, a fast-acting form of cancer and another person doesn't get it. But it was super painful. And for Megan, like, he's one of her best friends. You know, he had been down to Kochamo with us, like, the year before. And I was looking forward to having, like, adventures with him for many years to come. So that was really painful. But then on top of it, Maryland has, ever since I made my first trip to the mountains in Colorado, like after college, Maryland's always been a really toxic environment for me. Just because, like, I have no community, I have no climbing. You know, everything I do in my life, even from a writing perspective, tends to be about or somehow related to climbing. And so I was just really stagnating out there. And at the same time, like, I had, you know, Nick Hall had died maybe a year or two before. And then my friend Corey Hall died that same summer that I was living at Index. And then I ended up, like, in November before Megan's dad passed away, I was at the Gunks doing a slideshow up there about Kochamo. And a girl that I knew actually from Kochamo, a Chilean girl, died nearly in front of me, like, just a few routes over. And, like, you know, I came over and saw her lifeless body with people doing CPR on her. She was so cyanotic and like lifeless that I didn't even realize who she was until later on that evening when people started telling me about who she was. So all of these things were kind of adding up, and I just hadn't done anything to process them or like do anything to really acknowledge or address them. And in the months following Megan's dad's death, I was having a little bit of trouble sleeping. And so there were a variety of nights when I came downstairs, like poured myself a strong drink and started to write. And what initially came out was the middle part of this book. And it came out pretty quick. Like, I think it was maybe in three evenings. And it was just, I mean, if you read the book, you know, or if you're, you know, the listeners to this read the book, I think they'll feel like the middle part of the book is the most raw. And I think it just was my way of trying to, yeah, I mean, the protagonist in the middle part is like contemplating suicide, and, you know, he's trying to figure out whether it's worth going on after feeling, you know, slightly complicit in this thing. But I think it was just my way of sort of, climbing can be really shitty, you know, like climbing can be really shitty, and it can take the people you love, and then you like think about your kind of less valuable motivations for doing it. Like, you know, you maybe have at one time in your life thought, oh man, if I send this, like, I could do, I'm gonna, yeah, I'll have my project sent and then I'll do a social media post. Or like, oh yeah, if I send this, if I do this new route, I can do something in the American Alpine Journal, like do a story about it. Like, I don't know if that's just me. I mean, I'm sure other people can relate, but like, you're risking your life. And if that's what you're risking it for, it just sucks. And then when you think about maybe your friends died for similar reasons, you know, it's just super hard. And so I kind of just, I had to like come to terms with climbing in my own life and figure out why it was so important, why it was something that I was so fixated on. And part of that process for me was just to like come to terms with how hard climbing can be, you know, how challenging it can be in someone's life.
Interesting. At what point in time did you realize that, wow, this is actually a thing for me. I need to see this through. I need to commit to this project. When did that happen?
I sent it off to my friend, Katie Ives, who's the editor at Alpinist. And she kind of suggested that I apply to this program in Banff called the Mountain and Wilderness Writing Workshop. And, you know, that's graduated Katie and Freddie Wilkinson, Andy Kirkpatrick, Bernadette McDonald, and many more, like Jack Tackle, like lots of big name climbing writers. And I was like, whatever, I'll never get in, but I might as well try. And then I did get in, and I think that was maybe 2014. And that was the first time when I was like, huh, I wonder if there could be something to this where it's not just something that I'm doing for myself and like just to process things in my own life, but maybe this actually has legs as a piece of art that other people would be attracted to. Then when I went to the program, then it was basically like, yeah, the response was very, very positive. People were like, this is really good. No, you should totally do something with this. But they gave me direction, you know, and that was really important because I had kind of an idea or a vision in mind for what I wanted to be. But they gave me some concrete advice, you know, like, well, okay, so we need to care about the characters in the story, which means you need to develop them in the beginning. So that's part one, you know, is like character development. And then they were like, you know, you need to add a little bit to the end because it's just sort of like I had kind of left it as a cliffhanger where you don't even know what happens. And they were like, look, that's a cool thing to do, but for your audience, like it mostly just leaves them frustrated. So part three was kind of like resolution. And you got to understand, like, I've never studied writing before. So, you know, getting instruction is actually really valuable to me. And it helps me to learn how to, like, take the reader into account. Because for me, I was always like, why would you ever write for the reader? That's so unartistic and so, like, impure. You're just looking for accolades and you're just, like, hoping that people tell you how great you are. That's a horrible thing to do. You should only write for yourself. But at this point, I've realized that's actually bullshit. Like, there's nothing more selfish than writing for yourself.
Yeah, I agree.
And so if you're going to write, if you want people to read what you write, you gotta work with them. You know, you have to, like, give them something that they can hold on to.
Right.
And so Banff gave me the instruction and the guidance necessary to turn this book into something that I think people could enjoy or at least be moved by. And then after Banff, I went like a year without doing much with it because I had these sort of naive hopes and dreams that I was going to go to Banff and then write a letter to Penguin or Random House or whatever. And they were going to be like, great, we'd love to do a first run of a million copies and you can be an author for the rest of your life. I mean, I didn't really think that was going to happen, but I kind of hoped it would.
Well, yeah.
And when it didn't, I was really disheartened. And I was actually like about to give up on the project. But one of my clients, this guy, Carl Richards, who's this New York Times personal finance writer, he's a really awesome guy and like a friend and a mentor. He was like, dude, you're just afraid. Like, you're afraid to put it out there. You're afraid to try. You're afraid to be told that it's not good. And that's a stupid reason not to at least try to get this out there in some kind of way. And so he told me that he basically suggested I do a Kickstarter, even though I was totally terrified to do it and had really low expectations. I was like, all right, I'll try it. And I set the bar really low, you know, kind of at like the bare minimum that I thought I could raise if like my parents kicked in a bunch of money and Megan's mom kicked in a bunch of money and You know, it's like, all right, well, right. maybe I can make it if this happens and that happens.
Right.
But then the Kickstarter ended up doing really well.
Yeah.
It raised like $12,600 and there were like 230 backers.
Yeah.
And it was the coolest thing because there were a lot of people whose names I had never seen before. You know, I was expecting like this will be all my friends and they're all going to support me out of pity. But it was... This was probably the biggest confirmation of my life that maybe I'm a decent writer after all, and maybe like there's value to what I'm doing and people recognize that value.
Yeah.
And there's
there's also, I'm sure you can relate that there's something about getting acknowledgement from your peers in the community.
Yeah.
Like it's a real confidence builder.
Totally. Especially strangers. 'Cause like anytime a friend tells you you're great, you're like, well, yeah, you have to say that because you're my friend. But when people you don't know are interested or say nice things, you know, it has extra weight or extra value. So yeah, so then like the Kickstarter happened and it was successful, and then it was like, oh shit, well now I have to do this thing. I was like, oh my god, I have to do it. But I had enough money that I could actually do it exactly how I wanted.
Yeah.
And that meant
a relief.
Yeah, it was a huge relief. And I thought I was going to end up with like a little Christmas bonus, but it definitely didn't end up happening. Like I used every penny to make it happen. But it meant that I could make it a hardbound book. I could like pay my friend Sarah, who worked on the index guidebook, to do this awesome cover illustration. And I could pay my friend Craig Muterlach to do these incredible interior illustrations that were like, you know, a totally new style for him. Like he invented a style for this book.
Yeah.
I think the response from the community has been that people recognize that. You know, I think a lot of people, when they see the book, are sort of thinking, like people, I get this reaction often. I'll kind of tell someone about the book and they're kind of like semi-interested, and then I show it to them and they're like, whoa, wow, what is this? This is really cool. Like, I don't know if I've ever seen a book that looks like this and feels like this. And it has like this classic old school vibe, you know, sort of feels like it could have been written in like the 1920s or something.
Yeah, it actually looks like I have this old, it's like a 1920s Canadian Rockies little guidebook thing, and it's pretty much the exact kind of hardback in size as your book.
Yeah, I mean, it's super cool. Like, there's an old, I think it's Steve Roper. I think it's like an old Steve Roper guide to the High Sierra that is four times as thick as my book. But yeah, it's a green cover with like gold embossed foil stamp design, you know. Like I didn't invent this. I just like wanted to do something kind of old school and retro and funky.
You were following your vision.
Yeah, exactly. And the response from the community has been really, really nice, because you know, it's just a confirmation that you're not crazy. You know, like in my mind it made all the sense in the world that instead of just doing like the 8 millionth book with a paperback cover that's about climbing, that has to compete against all of the other climbing literature ever written, like doing something that's a little bit different that sticks out. Like that made sense to me, but you never know if you're right or wrong until people respond to it.
Yeah. Like, what is your vision? Like, first of all, how do you navigate the realities of being an independent artist? It looks really cool from the outside, but the reality is it's really, really challenging. It's a really hard way to make a living.
Well, I think like, the outside perception of being an artist is probably when you're watching a climbing video and someone's like way above their gear. You're like, wow, that looks so cool. It looks like really gripping, and that's probably really cool. And the like reality of being in that situation is being the person that's above his gear.
Yeah.
And it's just so intense because you're above your gear all the time. Like, you know, every time I get a paycheck, that's like a piece of pro. And if the paycheck's like $200, that's kind of a shitty piece of pro,
right?
You know? And if it's like, If it's $1,000, I'm like, all right, that'll catch me. But it's, you know, I should probably.
That was a bomber nut placement.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's like I'm going to get a paycheck this week, which is, or I hope this week, which is like a DMM offset, like perfectly slotted. But I think it's like true because I just constantly feel strung out, you know, and it's also exciting, you know, and so it is scary and it is like uncertain and you are kind of scared a little bit. But at the same time, I would probably get bored if I didn't have that like pressure and that stress. And I wonder if that's part of why I just seem incapable of getting jobs. Like maybe employers can smell that. On an application.
I know they can with me.
Yeah.
You know, I know in my own experience, like for me, you have to be really adaptable and I have to, there's a lot of different pieces that have to happen to make it work. But,
well, I think the key point is like, it will work, but you have to be flexible with your definition of what working looks like.
Yeah.
You know, and so my vision, my hope is that I can be a novelist and that this book will kind of kickstart that career and I can focus all of my energies on writing books. I think that's like if I had to give myself percentages of doing that at a level that can provide like a comfortable middle class living, I would guess I probably have like a 5% chance of making that happen.
Yeah.
But it's not zero.
Right.
And so I'm going to keep trying until that percentage gets down a lot closer to zero.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you the big mindset change for me after having a lot of letdowns in my life, you know, that related to doing the artistic things that I wanted to do. For me, the big change, the mindset change was that no matter what is you have to sit down and you have to do the work no matter what. If you want to live this kind of lifestyle, if you want to be successful and keep doing it, like even when you're having a shitty day, like even when you feel like it's not going to work out or it's not worth it. You have to set some sort of goal every day and you have to sit down and do the work. That's what it's been for me.
No, I completely agree with you. Like, you know, you can't just wait around for the muse to like come and strike because most of the time the muse is off with someone else. Yeah. Day in and day out, you have to stick with it. It's like climbing when you don't feel like climbing. You know, if you were like, if you decided you wanted to be a professional rock climber, then you'd have to do all this shit you don't want to do, like drinking smoothies in the morning and eating a vegan diet or whatever you need to do these days.
Doing photo shoots,
that's right. Doing pull-ups, all this stuff. So, you know, the path I've chosen has a bunch of itinerant bullshit, too. It's like everyone's path has a bunch of crap you have to do that you don't want to do. But you do it because that's the path you've chosen.
Yeah. You know, you recently just did some really cool climbing with Brett Harrington. And you've done a couple of what appear to be like really fun kind of wilderness adventure rock climbing trips. Mm-hmm. What are some goals you have moving forward as far as climbing and some adventures you'd like to do?
I think my biggest goal as far as climbing adventures goes is I would like to work towards getting my climbing in line with my values. And so like my values say that we're destroying the world at like a really rapid rate. And a big part of that is related to climate change, which comes from fossil fuel consumption and all these other things. And so, you know, like to me, it's not congruous to be like, hashtag protect our winters and hashtag like protect the mountains or whatever. And then at the same time, like fly into some remote range on helicopter. Even though I've done that and I'm certainly not judging anyone else, like I've done it and it's certainly fun. It's like an amazing opportunity to be able to do that. But I've also done new routes and had adventures here in the lower 48 that required driving for like 4 hours. And it's just a much lower carbon footprint. And I think that's more in line with my values. There is one caveat to that, which is Cochamó in southern Chile. I've been down there 6 times and I'm pretty invested in the future of that area. And the future is pretty uncertain. It's not protected. It's not like a national park or even a national forest. It's kind of a collection of private parcels. And I won't go into too much detail, but I'm trying to be very cognizant and present of what's going on in that area so that if and when there's a major threat, like just a couple years ago, there was a hydroelectric dam planned on the next river south of the Rio Cochamó. And fortunately, that was shut down due to really awesome grassroots efforts. But if there are development projects that occur in Cochamó, like I want to be able to position myself to be a force against that. And that requires going down there. Like, right. You could argue it doesn't. You could argue I could do all of that remotely. But I think it's just important, like, you know, I'm a gringo. Like, I'm just this foreign gringo. And so if I were to not go there and not have a presence in the community and not, like, show how much I care about it, I think that would limit my legitimacy in having a voice there.
Well,
and so that's, like, my one exception.
Right. Well, you also, you have to follow your instincts. And it sounds like your instincts tell you really unequivocally that you need to be there. So
yeah, Cochamó is super important to me. It's like kind of a pillar of my life, is that the people are important, the rainforest is important, the river is important. My ability to go climbing there is important for like psychological and mental reasons, you know?
Right.
But other than that, you know, like I'm excited to be in Flagstaff and I hope to kind of become a part of this community. I'd like to explore a little more around this area. I think Index will always be special and important to me, and I always want to go visit the Pacific Northwest in the winter. Oh, I'm sorry, in the summer. not so much the winter. Like, I think for me, it's become way less about traveling to the next exotic destination and way more about investing in places, almost as if they're people, you know, and developing communities or like being part of communities that, you know, I'm not trying to say I want to be some central figure that develops them. I want to have communities that, you know, that I can return to.
Yeah.
And I'd say that's like my climbing goals, really. I don't really care what grade I'm sending or whatever. I'd like to keep doing new routes because that's what I find to be most enjoyable. But, you know, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like without me even really having a visual of the terrain around you in Flagstaff, there's probably, for a certain kind of adventure, there's a lifetime of adventure for you right there.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah, like I went on this river rafting trip with a couple buddies on the San Juan River like a year ago, and it had zero to do with climbing, but we went on a hike one day and I found this really cool boulder that had this wavy face. Like if you've spent much time in the desert, you probably know what I'm talking about when it's like really dimpled and wavy and just cool. And like all of the holds were potato chips that were gonna break off, and the only way to climb the thing was to like push holds into the wall and somehow like figure out weird slabby like balancey stuff. And like I didn't have climbing shoes, so I was just climbing in these sort of like beat up kind of boat shoes, and you know, like palming down on these weird dimples and like kind of praying as I step up. And that was freaking amazing. You know, like, I'm not going to submit it to the AAJ. I'm not going to post about it on Instagram, but it was like an amazing experience. And
full value.
I would love to become a person that can like have that level of awesome experience in my own backyard, right. And not need to like travel around the world to do it.
All right, well, thanks for hanging out with me today. I hope you got as much out of Chris's stories as I did, and I hope you can apply some of his alpine and creative wisdom to your next trip in the mountains. If you want to get a signed copy of As Above, So Below, you can catch Chris this weekend on a book tour. He's in the Northeast, GP81 in New York City at 7:30 p.m. this Friday, and Rock and Snow in the Gunks at 8 p.m. on Saturday. Otherwise, you can head on over to chriskalman.com. You can purchase As Above, So Below or any of his other books there at the website. All right, so don't forget to leave a review for the podcast on iTunes or from within your favorite podcast app. And if you're a super fan of the Fern Line, if this podcast adds value to your life, please consider becoming a monthly backer on Patreon. Just head on over to thefernline.com, click on the Support the Fern Line tab, and you'll be directed to the relevant link. And finally, if you enjoy the tunes you hear on this show, you can check out more of my music on iTunes, Spotify, Bandcamp, and evanphillips.net. Until next time, I'm Evan Phillips, and this is The Fern Line.